So it's Monday afternoon and it's in March, and hopefully we're starting to see the sun coming out. Not today, but I got myself out into the square and had a wee personal training session for the first time that I've done that in a long time. So tomorrow I'm going to be sore, but thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was really great to motivate me and get me inspired for the chat this afternoon with a guest that I've only got to know lately, really, on LinkedIn and things like that. But it is Alan Armstrong, who is the founder and chief astronaut of Spaceman Marketing. And Alan's had great experience, you know, working for people like Ultimate Leisure and Stonegate, Nightcap, and brands like that. Made a great shift from operations and being in the thick of it, and also all the things like breaking up fights, being mates with bouncers and all this stuff, rubbing shoulders with the stars, then making the transition to marketing, where he's applying his trade, and I guess he's a personal trainer for marketing for your business as well. So if you're looking to get yourself match fit and get those customers coming in and spending their pounds with you again and again, and maybe even a wee bit more every time they visit, then I'd definitely get in touch with Alan at Spaceman Marketing. So we're a great chat about his experience. We kind of go down memory lane a little bit, talking about brands like Yeatsy's Wine Lodge and Pop World, which is still going strong. Then we get into marketing and his views on marketing, and talk about a few of the awards he's won as well, and why it's really important to stick to that brand DNA. Also, if you're interested, Alan talks about his freelancer journey, which is just fantastic as well. Really, really interesting. And then we go into a bit of future plans and what he thinks is going to be really vital for hospitality marketers to focus on. And then we get into the fun part. So anyway, I'll leave you with Alan. Really hope you enjoy the episode, and I'll see you at the end of the chat.
Supersonic.
Welcome to Supersonic Hospitality Marketing with me, Mark McSee, where we meet the most interesting people in hospitality, marketing, business, and beyond to hear tips, tricks, and tales to help your brand boom. This podcast is sponsored by Vita Mojo, the all-in-one restaurant management platform helping operators grow ATV, reduce tech complexity, and serve guests better. And now, here's a quick word from our sponsors. Vita Mojo is proud to be the headline sponsor of the Supersonic Marketing Podcast. Vita Mojo transforms chaos into confidence for hospitality operators worldwide, empowering brands to streamline order management and take control of their business. With its flexible end-to-end order management system, Vita Mojo gives you one central place to manage your menu across every channel, brand, and location. But Vita Mojo is much more than an out-of-the-box software solution. The Vita Mojo team are with you every step of the way, providing the partnership you need, the technology you want, and the experience your guests deserve, all in one place. Vita Mojo will help you adapt to whatever the world throws at your hospitality business. For more information, visit vitamojo.com/supersonic.
Hey Supersonic listeners, I'm Lucy, Head of Commercial at Airship and Toggle. I'm just interrupting this podcast to share a great opportunity for any operators out there. You might be aware, Airship is a leading hospitality marketing CRM, supporting operators by building a better understanding of their customers' visiting habits to help them target, personalise and automate marketing and deliver a return on investment. And Toggle, which is our gift card platform and generated a whopping £48 million for the sector in 2023 through the sale of prepaid gift cards, experiences, tickets, and so much more. We're giving away any lucky listeners a chance to get 10% off both onboarding and license fees with either of our platforms for this series only. Just quote Supersonic when inquiring with us via our website on airship.co.uk or usetoggle.com, and we look forward to speaking with you very soon.
which gives me the most spaceman out of this world pleasure ever to introduce my next guest, who is Alan Armstrong, founder and chief astronaut of Spaceman Marketing. Hello.
Hi, Mark. How are you? I don't know if I should be bowing to you right now because you're up there with my top three favorite marketeers just to start it off like that. I'm a massive fan of the show.
Well, thank you so much. Who's the other two?
Gary Vee, obviously, okay. And Mark Ritson.
I'm up with them?
Yeah, you're up with them. Yeah.
Crikey, both been on the podcast, by the way. Thank you so much. I'm blushing for that. That's so kind of you. So I guess we've got quite an online relationship, I guess, in that, you know, we've chatted loads of times on, you know, LinkedIn and stuff like that and swap messages and all that. And then, we were just kind of catching up the other week and we were sort of dancing around the subject of you coming on, and it was like, great, absolutely, you know. And I'm kind of in this mode at the moment that what I usually do is kind of restrict it to 10 episodes and then it's just 10 and then I just say no and have a wee rest. And then, but at the moment I'm just like, you know what, I just want to speak to more people and get as much, you know, content out there as possible for people to learn, and you know, every single one of them's helpful in their own way. So no, it's fantastic to meet you, and you know, we'll have loads of people in common and things in common, but you know, I'm looking forward to us being in touch more. So no, it's brilliant. So it's a Monday afternoon. Monday's been going okay?
Yeah, great at the minute. I've been working for a competitive socializing client all day today, doing some, and then getting prepped for the 2 days up Manchester for the NRB.
Yeah, I was meant to be going, actually. I'm sad that I'm not. I had it in my diary. I had the Midland Hotel booked. I had everything sorted. And then just working stuff's got in the way, unfortunately. So, yeah, I'm a bit bummed about that. But, yeah, okay, it's a bit of a dull day down in Brighton today. And I had my first ever personal training session this morning out in the square out there. And I'm going to be really sore tomorrow. I can feel it already. It's just like, oh God, what have I done? It's going to be an interesting day and night, I think. So you were saying you're up in Derby area?
I am, yeah. Obviously, we'll get into it in a bit, but my whole journey as a hospitality operator, like I kept getting moved further and further south away from the northeast, and then ended up in Derby and been stuck here ever since.
Yeah.
Which I find when you're in a marketing or central ops role for the big pub groups, it's just a perfect location. I can get north, south, east, west in 2 hours. It's an hour and a half into St. Pancras. It's just the most ideal place to do a national role, visiting multiple cities every week.
Yeah. I mean, how long is it into London?
It's an hour and a half train. If there's one stop at Leicester, then it's direct.
I mean, I'm in Brighton. I'm 2 hours each way, door to door. Like wherever I'm going, you know, so, but the train says it's an hour 10, it never is. So yeah, great. I mean, that's the thing, you know, you're getting down. So I used to live in Milton Keynes area and man, it was like 38 minutes or something, like, you know, straight in. And, you know, when you said to people where you live, Milton Keynes, I'm like, pfft. And then you said, where'd you live? Oh, Putney. And they were like, oh, it's an hour and a half, or whatever it was, you know, so actually you're better off and things are cheaper. What we asking for a pint up there? What's the score up there?
It's still around the £6 mark.
That's quite heavy. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. It's about £5.66 quid now.
Yeah, okay. That's a kind of on par then. I think we're about £6.50 here, yeah.
Yeah, I went to the box on Friday in Nottingham.
Oh, it's the best, isn't it? Oh. I worked on the brand for that with Martin. Defining the brand and all that, and I every time he opens one, I'm beaming with pride for them. You know, just it's such a great. Every city in the UK and beyond needs a box. Every single city needs a box.
Totally agree. It's one of my favorite brands out there, if I'm honest with you, right now, when it comes to the sports proposition, but also just their customer journey and their look and feel of their venues. It's got everything, hasn't it? It's got absolutely everything from start to finish, and. Uh-huh. I can just, if I have an admin day or one of my backpack days, I'll just go and sit in there all day in Nottingham all day and go through coffee, lunch, after work, the whole shebang there, can't you?
It's the food as well, you know, I mean, shout out to Ian and John, like, yeah. Oh my God, like, see that chicken shawarma they've got? It is still one of the nicest things I have ever eaten. I think it is absolutely top drawer stuff, really classic.
I also think as well, their £7 lunch deal.
Is it?
It's just unreal for the market. About £7 lunch deal with things like their Rob Burrows burger on there, which donates to Emmy.
Oh, yeah.
And for £7 for a decent homemade burger and chips, you just can't go wrong anywhere else in the high street.
Yeah.
It's even Friday. I looked at the main menu and looked back at the £7 lunch attachment thinking, I'm just going to stick with that. There's some cracking dishes on there.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. It was absolutely amazing.
That's Boots Meal Deal territory, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely, even your McDonald's is crouching on that pricing now, isn't it? So
easily. But he's, him and Annie and, you know, all the team and everything, you know, they're one of my favourite clients I've ever worked with, you know, I loved. And I think it was just more, I think it's a northern thing, like, just how direct they are, like, in a nice way. There's no fluff. You just know exactly where you stand. You know, really good motivator. He's always up as well. Like, the energy of Martin, I just cannot believe. He's a real inspiration, you know. He's like, you know, there's been a few days where I've been a bit like, meh, you know, this and that. And see if you're ever feeling a bit lower, well, go and talk to him. He'll kick you up the bum and then get you back out in the field, you know. Absolutely brilliant stuff. Yeah, love that man. So I guess in terms of you then, so tell us about Spaceman Marketing and what you're doing now then. What's going on? So you said competitive social client you had and whatever you have and what else is going on?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. It was never the plan to go freelance. I left NICAP for various personal reasons of my wife had put her career on hold in mental health for 7 years to raise our kids. As you know, in hospitality, it's 24/7. I was in London 3 days a week. You're on trains. You're first out the door in the morning. You're laid back when the kids are in bed.
Yeah.
She said, look, I want to go back to my career. So we did all the maths around salaries and all that type of stuff. And I said, you know what? Let's say I'm traveling out to London 3 days a week. I'll take 6 weeks off to have the kids for summer holidays and have some quality time with them. And then I'll see what opportunities pop up. And then it was never the plan to do it. It's something I've always thought of at various points in my career, but then never had the balls to go through with it. Because of this, it scares some people when it comes to the lack of salary and the consistency in workload and all that, and paying your mortgage. And then, but it's, I think it was like this, I left NICAP, and it was almost this next day, my phone just kept ringing of all these people who'd seen that I'd left on LinkedIn and was saying, we've always been a fan of yours. Will you work for us one day a week? We could never afford you when you were on a salary, but we could afford you one day a week. And then my clients just kept picking up. And it started off with the guys at Pub Quiz who do smartphone speed quizzes. And I've been working with them since day one now as on a retainer basis. And then ever since then, it's just been little pub groups who've got no marketing structure, who want the strategy and the support behind them. And then competitive socializing group came along and took a day and at the minute you say touch wood, 5 days a week work for the next 4 weeks of my calendar. So it's make hay when the sun shines in freelance world, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, go back to that because I'd like to stand in that feeling for a bit because I've had exactly the same feeling, of course. And so you're in jobs, it's secure. Have you got any advice about how to make that leap?
Yeah, I mean, the first advice is build your network.
Yeah.
It's to have that strong network, either it's through tools like LinkedIn. LinkedIn's been probably the most valuable tool I've leaned on since going freelance. I signed up to the Chamber of Commerce and all these things and completely waste of money, completely waste between me and you. But when it comes to...
Sorry, Alan, just to say it's not between me and you, it's between us and them.
True. Yeah. Yes,
and you that's listening.
But when it came, it was just building up my network and then almost as well, build up your skill set. The biggest learning I've had since going freelance is you don't have a team to lean on anymore. I mean, I had teams of up to 16 people that we had guys doing influencers, guys doing social media, guys doing POS. They were doing everything.
Yeah.
And I was just almost a director of making sure they're all on time.
Yeah.
Now I'm in a world where I've had to teach myself how to do stuff on Canva. I've had to teach myself paid social. I've had to teach myself content creation and video editing.
Yeah.
But them skill set, if I built them up whilst I was in the salaried world, then you become a more all-rounded freelancer, I think. I think it's build up your network, and also as well when it comes to taking that leap, if just being brave and trusting in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I never had that self-confidence to do that for years. And the whole time I probably was missing out on a trick. I probably had loads of stuff I could have added value to customers like I am now. But almost taking that leap completely accidentally and then building it and building it and building it, it's been fun. It's been a really, really fun exercise. And you're probably the same. You just can't beat working for yourself when it comes to having that choice of the clients you work with. I feel you have a different dynamic with clients than you do when you're with like CEOs and line managers and things like that. And yeah, it's been a hell of a journey, but I've absolutely loved it so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that you've done it. And I think, you know, you've come up with a really cool name and, you know, the Chief Astronaut thing's fun, I think, you know, from that perspective. In terms of the name and all that, you know, where did that kind of come from? Was it just a bit of fun or what was going on?
It was various things going on in my life right now. My 7-year-old daughter was in a choir and she was singing the Sam Ryder song. So every day she'd come home and she was singing Spaceman all around the kitchen and doing rehearsals and stuff. And that stuck in my head. But then with a surname like Armstrong, rather go down the route of a drug taking cyclist or the first man on the moon.
Yes.
I just went down that route and just started playing about it and thinking, you know what, there's something in this. And then I started then positioning myself of where I want to sit as a freelance, because I didn't want to come across as an agency. I didn't want to come across as a multiple facet of a big organization or faceless organization. I wanted to be about me. I want to be about a singular person. But then I wanted it to be the way I always worked as a marketing director, which was, I'm not a specialist in all areas. I'm not an expert in all areas. I am, though. I'm part of a wider universe of fellow freelancers who I can pull in to help me out projects. I have copywriters. I have guys who do digital audits for me. I have guys who do video content. I'm part of a wider universe of fellow marketeers. And that's almost what I provide my clients, is that I'm open and honest and saying, look, you come to me for this, but I do know what it is. I'm going to lean on this person and I'm going to pay them a few hundred quid to do it for me.
Yeah.
But you get the 100% holistic expert marketeer, because I'm pulling on different people around hospitality who've done the job for me, who are almost in my backpack of tools and tricks of when I was in corporate world of being able to use for different projects. And now you get access to them through me, all through me.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was almost a bit of a positioning, but then a bit of fun around Armstrong and that name connection.
Yeah, I think it's good. Well, I guess you could have Louis Armstrong, maybe something to do with jazz, or there's jazz from Babylon Zoo, the Spaceman song, if you're old enough to remember that one.
I've got all them sound clips saved in my website as audio that plays when you first log on, but I've never actually switched them on yet.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
People there as well. Dido, she was in Armstrong as well.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. She was a famous one.
Nice. Well, don't hide anyone in the boot of your car, I guess. So in terms of, you know, starting the business, then what were all the things you had to think about? So, you know, website, business cards, just again, for anyone listening that's wanting to start up, you know, what were the things that you did at that point?
Again, I think I was very guilty of overthinking this. The website was crucial straight away. And when I did that, I knew I just wanted to build myself, build it really functional, just more of a point of reference. I never wanted someone who was going to get huge amounts of data traffic and things like that. And I also had a journey in my mind about how I was going to build my personal brand over the few months of things I was going to do for hospitality, things like my newsletter. Yeah. The newsletter came 2 months after, because I always did that when I was in the corporate world. I used to do it in Stonegate and it gets circulated around Simon Longbottom's desk and all the different directors. I used to do it then at NICAP, and Sarah and everyone would get access to it. And everyone always loved it. Everyone loved the fact that I took the best bits of Propel and CGA and Proof and Cam and everyone and stitched it together.
Yeah.
And so I kept doing that initially just because I wanted to obviously keep myself fully immersed in hospitality. But then, as sort of doing it, people would just, again, message me out of blue saying, are you still doing them newsletters? Can you share it with us? And then all of a sudden it was a post on LinkedIn and a few people downloading it to now I've got, I think it's 103 subscribers on my email list of who, and I'm getting a 60% click-through rate every month. It's become a really powerful tool where I built that. And then I layered the blogs on top. The blogs were just again, the start off ramblings of a madman of this is stuff I've learned in my career, which I think is useful for people to share.
Yeah.
And we wanted to be in a position where I was giving back and giving it out for free. So I started the blogs as well, started layering that. But yeah, so I always had a plan with how I was going to structure my first 6 months when it came to surviving. And that's how I've always positioned this is it's a bit of fun. I'm having a great time doing it. I'm doing some really viable work for some clients. But it's month by month, as you know, in this game. It's month by month, knowing your pipeline's there for the future and giving yourself that breathing space, that admin day to do some outreach and touch base with people and do a bit of cold messaging and things, which people hate, but it still keeps your name out then.
Yeah.
And then like I said, I almost overcomplicated from day one because I went down a route of Calendly in links on my website where people could book slots for me. No one's ever booked a slot with me, Mark, just to put it on.
It's such a funny one, that Calendly one, because it is easier, of course. I find that being one of the hardest tasks I've got to do in my job, which is booking appointments, arranging my days. And, you know, I've had support in the past, but I didn't like it. I liked being in control of my diary and knowing what I was doing and things like that. So, yeah, I find that really stressful. However, with the Calendly stuff and the other sites like that, it depends what your service is, but it can be a little bit passive aggressive. And basically what a lot of agencies or people that are trying to sell things to me do in LinkedIn, it's like, you know, hey, I want to have a meeting with you about something you probably don't want, but here's a Calendly link to, and you're like, what? So yeah, I think for loads of occasions it's great, but one of the things that I've always tried to do in my life, and you know, certainly in client work and freelance and stuff, is never give someone else something else to do. Yeah. You know, like make everything as easy as possible so that when that person has to think about you, they think, he gives me no hassle, he gives me no trouble, you know, he just gets it done, you know, Big Mark will help you out kind of thing. That's it, you know. So yeah, it is a funny one, that. But I might have it on my website. I'm not entirely sure, but I might have it on my website. And then what I ended up doing, which is quite bad actually, but I put a pick my brains tariff on my website because I get it like all the time. I mean, I don't really talk to folk that I want to help and stuff, but you get a lot of people taking them out, you know, people with real money who've never given you anything. You know, I always think it's a value exchange. And, you know, I've got this product that I'm going to make millions off of. You know, can I pick your brains for free? And you're like, well,
yeah,
you know, so it kind of, you know, it's nice to have that there, you know, if you need it. And then just in terms of the services that you offer then, what's that sort of suite look like?
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember when I first started when I first went freelance, I had a call with a few other people who've done the same journey as me. And the first question they asked me was, what's your USP?
Mm.
I spent my life immersed in USPs with different brands, but I'd never thought about it for me. And
yeah,
I was honestly answering the first month or so. I was saying, I don't really know. I really don't know. I just and now as I'm almost 7-8 months in, as I am, I'm almost now sculpted into. I like to help businesses, hot light businesses, grow bigger. Mm-hmm. That's almost what I've summed it down to. As in, my sweet spot, which I tend to find right now, is I've got guys who are up and coming suppliers, products, pub groups. That almost strive for, they'd love to have a marketing director someday. They strive for having a 3-year strategy and a brand plan and a campaign calendar and all of that, but they don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
And so the way I always do it is I come into my marketing MOT or marketing audit, as some people call it, where I do 6 weeks almost fully immersed in their business, where I look at every single touch point possible, from how they're acquiring customers on their website to their paid socials to brand awareness scores, customer experience in venue, everything. And then I go back with a simple SWOT analysis, action report, action log, everything. I'm just saying, guys, these are three big things for you. It's as simple as all marketers use of where are we now? Where do we want to be? How do we get there? Mm-hmm. I've written their three parts and then go back them with a full list of everything that I think needs fixed, whether it's the website's leaking customers, or their customer journey is not the best, or in venue, this experience is terrible, or something like that.
Yeah.
And then it's up to them. They either keep me on and I'm more willing to stay on and do a day a week or a couple of days a week, helping them work through their problems with their internal teams.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can take a list and hire a marketing manager or marketing exec to do it all for me. I mean, I always say when I'm with every client, my ambition for every client is almost, I make myself redundant eventually.
Yeah.
That they get big enough and get confident enough where they bring on their own marketing resource and they execute the plan that we've put together.
Yeah.
And then I can move on to someone else. So yeah, the marketing MLTs are my best selling product. That's tends to be how I get in with these groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and like I said, almost when it gets to the end of that period, they all say, yeah, why don't you stay on and help us out? Help us with the doing. Help us get it all done.
Yeah.
Stay on and help them all do it, whether it's through me or through some of my universe of other freelancers I use, but I become their lead contact. And then that's where I've almost positioned myself as well, is that I'm a day rate marketing director.
Mm-hmm.
I give them levels to the experience of a board level marketing director, but they can have it as a bite-sized day. And then, you know, it's like with clients as well, they never stick within their allotted day. They ring you at every day in mornings and they're all like, are you working for us today? Nope. Oh, but we'll hear in a little conference call there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing that I've found as well. And, you know, I get a lot of people saying, well, you know, what about balance and all that? And it's a bit like, well, I think if you are in this game, if you like, I kind of feel that having boundaries is great, of course. But I think because a lot of hospitality is still quite old school and it is so rapid that even if you leave someone for even a few hours, they can be a bit like, oh, well, they're not bothered then, kind of thing. Because also, you might have other clients, but everyone wants you to be like Robbie Williams or whatever, you know, going, you know, you're better than last night's audience or, you know, all that stuff. You know, you need to make them feel special. So I think that's, so yeah, it's just the way that I do it. I mean, there's all sorts of, I mean, I really respect a lot of people that go, look, at five, I'm done. And I'll be back at nine or whatever. But I guess being a freelancer as well, there's a lot of people in it that are kind of people pleasers as well, that they just want to, you know, they want to help people. So yeah, you make yourself available, which is a sacrifice. But at the end of the day, that'll build your reputation. You'll get your back rapid. And then just in terms of you and hospitality then, so, you know, you started many, many years ago in that, and a bit of operations experience and that kind of thing. So it'd be good to go back to that then, you know, and what that world was like and when that was and how you got into it.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I was, to probably go back, I was 16 years old. I grew up in a really rough area of the Northeast, to put it simply. And I was a teenager who lacked a lot of self-confidence, had terrible acne, rubbish with girls, all this type of thing. And then I almost stumbled across this part-time job of a glass collector in a CIU social club. And it was 300 capacity. They only needed me when there was functions on. So I did a lot of weddings and christenings and wakes and all that type of stuff, 18th birthdays. And I remember from the day one I joined, that buzz of the atmosphere from the DJ, from the crowd, from everyone dressed up to have a really good night out on Friday, Saturday. I mean, this is the mid to late 90s as well.
Mm-hmm.
You had that, I don't know if you remember, before the smoke ban, you had that haze of smoke.
Yeah.
You know, menus that almost hung around 2 foot to 6 foot in the air.
Yeah.
And one of my jobs was going around emptying ashtray bins and all that type of thing, which stung.
Yeah. Nasty.
I loved it from day one, and I almost loved it. And it was that buzz that just becomes so infectious straight away. And it definitely wasn't for the money. I remember getting paid £10 cash in hand every night for 4 hours work. And then I'd spend £4 or £5 of it at the Chinese restaurant on my way home, passing it on as I walked back home afterwards. And I just absolutely loved it. And then from that point onwards, it was a funny setup there, because I remember the guy who ran it, the secretary, he was very much, you can't leave until you find someone to take your job. I think, what? You can't leave until you find someone, you find a friend who's going to take your job. So I give it to my brother. I give it to my little brother. He was 2 years younger than me. And then I went off to a company called Ultimate Leisure, who were getting big in the Northeast around that time. It was a guy behind them called Bob Senior.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a complete industry legend.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's still involved now.
I know the name.
Yeah, he's still involved up there with a few like restaurant concepts and things around Newcastle and Durham and Sunderland, places like that. But he was opening he had a hotel in Whitley Bay, which was massive, with all the Scots on Bank Holiday Mondays, and it was just the place to go up there for a full day drinking session.
Mm-hmm.
And he was opening a new bar up there, and then he offered me a job there to be glass collector again. And then again, I just, the buzz and excitement of doing this job, it took over my life. Affected my studies, my A-levels. I did all right with them, but I almost just, whenever the shift came free at the bar, I was there. Wednesday night, Tuesday night, Thursday night, whatever it was, I was there. And then as you do, you graduate, you get 18, you go from glass collector to barman to supervisor, and you just get it just helped. It was weird. It was just you got promoted based on it. You realize it was a meritocracy in hospitality. Mm-hmm. Hard work you will get somewhere if you work hard in this industry.
Yeah.
And it can be whoever you want, but as long as you work hard and do your job, you will keep progressing forward. And I absolutely loved that around it. And because I was from such a working class background, I knew really early on that to get anywhere in life, I was going to have to really graft to get there. Because not many of my friends or family went to university, who probably about 10% of people I went to school with did end up going to university. Majority fell into trades as electricians and things like that. But I remember going to Career Advisor and at a similar time, and I'd been recently diagnosed with being really badly colorblind, which is a fascinating story of being a marketeer. But I was really badly colorblind, and she almost went through the pen of every job I couldn't do. You can't be a policeman, you can't do the army, you can't do this, you can't do that, because of your colorblindness. So I'd be obviously chasing the wrong car or painting the wrong fence and all that type of stuff. I always thought it's either university or I'm going to just keep working hard. Or the other route was sport. I mean, I was in the same class at school as Michael Carrick, who went on to... Yeah. And my school just kept putting people through football. I think Steve Bruce, Peter Beardsley, there was a string of footballers who'd come through our school. But I was never very good at football. Never very good where I thought I could have gone to a top uni, and then I couldn't qualify for any trades. Just thought, you know what, I'm going to keep working hard at hospitality to see where it takes me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a big thought. You know, we talked about Hospitality Rising, which was this start here, go anywhere. We really love that line and that thought, and, you know, we might use it again in the future. You know, I just thought it's so true. You know, and as you say, it really is mostly in your own hands. Where you go in hospitality, and if you're in a place that there's a glass ceiling or, you know, they won't let you, then you just go somewhere else that will. And you know, if you just keep moving, and also it takes you all around the world. I mean, it doesn't mean to say you have to stay in, you know, the area that you're in or anything like that. You know, it really can take you wherever, and you can get into, you know, rubbing shoulders with celebs and, you know, and all these kind of things. And, you know, just thinking about that, you know, working with Ultimate Leisure, I think you've got a couple of stories about celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, when I got in with Bob and in Ultimate Leisure, and like I said, started down Whitley Bay, and then he bought a new venue on Newcastle Quayside. And at the time, late 90s, Newcastle Quayside was where everyone wanted to be from an aspirational perspective around Newcastle. You had the Tuxedo Princess.
I've been there a few times actually. Yeah, in the past.
You had Bar, Beach Club, you had some amazing venues down there. This is in Newcastle at the time. You only had the big markets in the Quayside. That was your two choices. Mm-hmm. And you launched this massive venue down there. And pretty much the way it worked was every time there was a major celeb at the Newcastle Arena, they'd want to come to us for after party. We'd get it all the time. And my job, I think I was assistant manager at the time, but my job at the time was, because we had such a big queue, is I had to go out and pick all the pretty girls out of the queue. That was my job at the time. I had to pull them out and get them to the front. I was on the door all the time. I remember being stood in the door one night, and these two guys came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Can we come in?" I went, "No, sorry, guys. You've got to join the queue. It's all the way down there. Join the queue and you'll get it." Yeah. They said, "No, we want to come in. We're on deck." I went, no, you're not. You're far too short. They were tiny. I mean,
they're very small.
And I told them to go and join the queue, and then took somebody else to Fagnes it, Alan, and they actually are. And shouldn't let them in. But I just let them in and get them a drink and doing all of that. At the time, I think it was the Kevin Keegan era of football. We used to get all the Newcastle players in. You get them in all the time.
Yeah.
And then one particular night, I remember getting a late night phone calls from Robbie Williams security. He just finished a gig. He was in his height of his stardom around the Angels era and all of that. And he said, look, Robbie's finished his gig. He wants to come and party. And we went, well, we're full. We're completely full. The capacity, the queue's down the street. There's no seats. And he almost gave us a list of everything we had to do to meet their conditions if we wanted to come down. We had to kick people out of booths and move people around and get drinks on a table ready. And then I remember this tour bus pulling up outside and this big group of security with all the radio mics on and all that kind of thing, like SAS soldiers all coming out, marching out first, getting in positions around the venue. And then in he came, got very merry, put it that way. He definitely partied.
Had a good time.
He definitely got refreshed after his concert. And then, he left with two of Newcastle's finest females and two bottles of tequila. And off he went back in his tour bus and off he went back to his hotel.
Rock and roll.
So he was there all about half an hour. The random story around it, I remember him snogging Chris Waddle.
Oh, wow.
All I remember about that whole night, apart from obviously all the entrance and stuff, is looking over to check if he was all right. And there he is, him and Chris Waddle, having this like fun snog going on.
And, he's a legend, though. He is a legend. I remember I used to have the Marseille, the Chris Waddle Marseille top. When he used to be there, you know, absolute legend. So, yeah, you know, I don't know if I'd snog him, but you'd be certainly pleased to see him. That's for sure.
Yeah, it was a very random experience walking into the VIP room to see that. But, yeah, he had a great time and he left happy. So that's what we always try to deliver.
Pre-social media as well, all that going on.
Social media, look at the air.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, obviously you were moving on then and you see you were getting up the ladder and all these things and you were managing, you know, sort of these venues at 21. Mm. I mean, what did you sort of find there? You know, what were the key lessons and how did you even manage that? I mean, if I think of it, 21, I don't even think I was finished uni.
I know. I mean, looking back, was I underqualified? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Without my depth, yes.
Yeah.
But at the time, it came naturally because I've been in the venue since 16 and I've been constantly working in every job possible. I just, Bob just kept opening new venues and he was pushing his boundaries further and further south in the northeast, if I'm honest with you. So he bought a venue in Durham, a student bar, and he sent me down there to do some work there first of all, as like a sort of holding manager whilst they got it established or everything. A random story that I had from there was I remember standing outside, and this was like a weird three-story student venue on the river next to Durham Uni, full of Durham students. Mm-hmm. It's still now, I think it's still there now. It's still an institution. But I remember standing back in its beer garden and with this security guy, this door staff guy, going, how do you know if there's trouble at the front door?
Mm-hmm.
How do I know if there's trouble at the front door? And you're standing with a tennis ball in his hand all the time. I said, you guys have radios like normal nightclubs do. And you went, well, if it kicks off, yeah, it was a fight. I throw this tennis ball over the roof as best I can. And then the guys at the front door see the tennis ball land and they all come running to help me. And I was just thinking, what happens if you miss? What happens if it bounces off the roof and comes back to you? It was just too impressive. Yeah. One of those random stories the doorman's ever told me was around tennis balls for his security flag. I did some time in Durham, then did a beach club in Sunderland, and then they pushed me into Rotherham. That was my first GM appointment on my own, he said 21 years old.
Yeah.
1700 capacity nightclub, Rotherham proper sub town to the likes of Sheffield. You lost a lot of customers into Sheffield and Pisa. I think I was listening to your podcast with Dan Brookman the other day, and I was just he was probably running venues in Sheffield the same time I was in nearby Rotherham trying to meet his customers.
Yeah,
but it was tough. It was hard. The way I always approached it when I went to any new venue was you try and get the security on your side straight away.
Yeah.
Your head doorman's your best friend.
Yeah.
He's the one who's got your back when things go wrong, but he's the one who helps enforce all your ideas around customer safety and everything like that, because he's the main person. So I always just spend time on the front door to help manage my own crowd. So I'd really take time to make sure you get the right crowd inside the venue.
Mm-hmm.
So then you'd have the obviously happy customers and all that type of thing. And then just spend loads of time just training the team. We used to get them all in for cocktail training, flair training, dance mm-hmm. training, because mm-hmm. we used to do routines every half an hour. And yeah, it was great. I absolutely loved it there. And so you said age, after a while, this didn't really matter to me because everyone in that club was probably a similar age, from the our team to the managers that are around me and all that type of thing. And I also found as well, being a strange city in a small town, it's just that local networking was key as well.
Yeah.
Because whenever I went out anywhere, whether I was going for my weekly shop or my haircut, whatever, I had a pocket full of VIP tickets in my pocket and everyone knew the club as me. So I'd walk around and we used to do a lot of emphasis on the whole Novus Network 21 type scheme where you'd have businesses you try and liaise with closely. And if it was anyone's birthday, it was all the era of text messaging there, they'd text message you direct.
Yeah.
Things like that. It was just pre-CRM and everything.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was a great success. And even when it came to your competitors, because you were out and you were immersed in it, even two nights of club was shut, we were in Sheffield partying ourselves, or we were in rival venues playing pool and watching sports. You were just immersed in hospitality.
Yeah.
It was a good part of my life.
I mean, it sounds exciting. And, you know, I always feel, I wish I had, worked in hospitality like when I was younger. You know, I worked in record shops and things like that. And, you know, I just think it would have been such a buzz to have done it, you know. But I think, you know, looking at the venues that you were operating and at that age as well, I mean, I think it's a lot to take on. But I think when you talk about careers and jobs and hospitality and all the rest of it, it really is, you know, the world's your oyster. If you're not as academic or you don't want to sit in an office, you know, I mean, this is just, you know, it's almost like a mini MBA. Or, you know, because you're having to figure out social skills and finance and stock control and merchandising and marketing, and, you know, just all these things, you know, every single time. And then if trouble did kick off in a venue, you know, what sort of happened there? I'm reminded of last night, I think, I saw a social media clip that it kicked off in Liverpool at a Mother's Day lunch. They're all punching each other, like all the women are punching each other and... in one lady gets an absolute crack in her head, you know, it's just like, Jesus. So yeah, what happened if you saw that kicking off? I mean, was it regular?
I mean, the bit around late night back then is there was quite a lot of trouble. There was. I mean, the key from whenever it did happen was to isolate and get it out of the venue as fast as you could.
Mm-hmm.
You never wanted to have a brawl in the middle of the dance floor and have it going on for 10, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And you never wanted the police to have to come into your venue. That was just a big move from a licensing perspective.
Yeah.
So we used to have, you'd have code words, you'd have select fire exits. Like you'd say to people, right, you just go in as a group, isolate the group and get them all out the doors as fast as possible. And if they continue fighting in the street, they continue fighting in the street, and then they're on CCTV and the police are outside and all that type of thing. It always becomes their problem.
Yeah.
It was all about just not letting it spill over where it affects as many guests, other guests in the venue.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You'd have 1,700 people in there and you'd have one group of idiots decided to have a kickoff.
Yeah.
And that's what I realized about all the different towns I worked in, is that you'd have a different fighting mentality in every single one. You'd have somewhere it'd be ones and twos. You'd have places like Rotherham where it'd be 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So one village against another village, and Durham was the same. You'd have big groups against each other, so it was a complete different problem to trying to get one person out.
But
late night wasn't always about that as well. Obviously you did have the intoxication element as well, but it was the times, or just changing the times around. It was still 11 o'clock pubs and 2 o'clock clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember them days where you'd run from the pub at five to 11 to be in the queue for the club because you'd never get in. It wasn't 4 years now.
Yeah.
And so you'd have people who'd go out at 6, 7 o'clock. They'd be in the pub, all the way down the pub crawl. And then they'd naturally end up at your door at 11 o'clock and be queuing to get in for an extra couple of hours of partying before everywhere shut at 2 o'clock. And everywhere did, didn't it?
Yeah. Every time. I mean, there was just always that stress. Will I get in? Won't I get in? And especially if you were underage as well.
Yeah.
You know, that was even worse if you'd, you know, made the train journey and all the rest of it. So, you know, it was, you know, I'm glad things have changed. And then obviously there's kind of the whole food system supporting it after, and place you're open later and you've got your, you know, deliveries and Just Eats. And, you know, so it's a very, very different experience. But obviously, you know, night life, if you like, or night clubs, it's interesting what's happened with, you know, after COVID and all these things. And it really does feel like a bit of a watershed moment that, you know, the next generation won't almost have what we had, you know, which is a real shame.
Yeah, but I tend to think, I tend to think positively around this, if I'm honest with you, Mark, because I think that these things, these trends happen in circles, as we see in marketing all the time, whether it's a 30-year cycle or whatever. And I think clubbing is just going to go underground and rave scene for a bit. That's what it is today. You're going to see a lot more warehouse projects and things like that. It's a smaller market, but there'll be a group of people who will go to a club at midnight and party till 4, 5, 6 in the morning, and that'll
be cool.
But then the period we're in now, where people are going out Saturday daytimes, they're doing bottomless brunches, they're home by 11 o'clock, that'll move on, and things shift and things go around in cycles. And I think where clubbing probably is now is probably where it probably was in the late 90s, and it might take 20-30 years, but I think it will come back, and we will start to see people discover that market and start to realize that they can party all night and all of that again. Because at the minute but it had to be a natural thing that was going to happen, because you had COVID of 2 years of 18-year-olds being locked up, never realizing what a nightclub was, because they were 1 meter distance and wearing masks and all that type of thing. That culture sticks, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
A creative agency for the hospitality sector, Saved by Robots create compelling brands and memorable experiences through great design and engaging storytelling. From Scottish Restaurant of the Year Sugar Boat to Tipjar, the digital tipping platform that's taken over the world, Saved by Robots excel at bringing ideas to life. As well as developing new concepts and refreshing existing brands, the robots provide outsourced graphic design to help multi-site operators grow with confidence. Check out their work and get in touch at savedbyrobots.com.
Triple Seat, the ultimate event management software for your hospitality venue. Used by 15,000 venues globally, including Daisy Green, Aqua, Nobu, Puttshack, and many more, join Triple Seat today and grow your event business. Our web-based software saves up to 30 plus hours of event admin time per month. Go from inquiry to booked event quicker with Triple Seat. We integrate into leading platforms like OpenTable and SevenRooms. Cut down on event admin and streamline the event management process with Triple Seat. Book a demo today at tripleseat.com.
So I guess then you've went from the, you know, the mucky world, I was going to say, or the mucky world or hard work world of ops, and then went into the crayons department, as a lot of operators like to call it, of marketing. So what brought that about, and was that something you'd aspired to get into?
No, not at all, to be honest with you. It was never the plan. It was completely by accident. And then as soon as the smoke and ban hit, I soon twigged on that I was a wet lead operator. I was a completely wet lead. As soon as the smoke and ban hit, everything became food lead all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It was the birth of casual dining and all of that. And I had no food in my CV at all. So I remember going to Yates' Wine Lodge and did a year over there under Toby Smith when he was there, and just to build up. But then I think at the time Laurel went bust. And then Abby Dunn came in and nicked me for Revolution. Did some time at Revs opening their new £2 million site in Loughborough, which I loved again. I learned more in 6 months from the team at Revolution at the time than I did probably my whole career before that, pre-sales and marketing from Carl Morris and all these brilliant people that they had working for at the time. It was an unbelievable time because I was a new site. I got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
So just 6 months there, but then... I think at the time that venue shut at 3, so I was getting home at like 6 a.m. So it was like an all day job. It was like every day was an AFD.
Mm-hmm.
So then went to Slug and Lettuce. And I think I just took everything I learned at Slug at Revolution and nightclubs and came to pre-book sales, running an event, everything. And I took over this Slug and Lettuce in Derby, which was 5 minutes from where I lived at the time. And as you normally do, you get I got a missus at the time in that city and started to settle down. And then I just started to turn the sales bit by bit through doing the stuff I did. I was doing live music events. I was going to bid off brand. I was probably annoying the brand manager at the time. So I was constantly messaging saying, you've sent me POS 3 days before the event. You expect me to do a good job of this. What is this?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was just chirping in this poor brand manager's ear constantly. And then at the same time, though, I was driving top line sales. I mean, Toby Smith himself used to say you could see an Allen P&L straight away. It was green at the top, red in the middle, and green at the bottom. Because I spent money, but I made more sales and more profit.
Yeah.
And so they started asking me, and it was Mary Wilcock at the time who was running Stuck on that, saying, look, we've got a few troublesome sites. I remember going to Milton Keynes branch and
I know that one went.
Right, we went to Bromsgrove and Worcester and everywhere. I was getting sent everywhere on the patch to say reviewing their rhythm of the week, as we call it, looking at what they're currently doing from a market perspective, looking at the events and just trying to drive the sales. And the results were coming through every time I did it. And it got to the point where I was only actually in my own venue 2 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then a marketing exec vacancy came up and they asked me to go for it. And it was just my dream job. I was almost doing marketing without knowing I was doing marketing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I was doing the events, I was doing my own marketing plans, I was doing it all, but not being trained in marketing.
Yeah, it's just what you would have done.
Yeah, so I remember the first request I made when I accepted the job was, I'll do it, but you guys are sending me back to university.
Mm-hmm.
Send me to university. I'd never been.
Yeah.
And so they said, what do you mean? I said, well, I need to learn. I want to learn the lingo. I said, people use all these models and they use all these words and I want to be able to hold myself credibly in a meeting. And they agreed. So I went back to night school for a year and did the CIM. Which was, I remember it every Tuesday night for a year, doing 4 modules and assignments and essays and case studies. But probably the best thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
Honestly. And it's weird now. When I started then as a more senior person with people in my team, whenever I took people on, I give them the same facility.
Mm-hmm.
Said to them, look, this is your salary, but what we're going to do is we're going to send you for a tonight school to do a CIM because it's the best thing I learned.
Yeah,
it was. I learned all the lingo and learned models that still carry around with me today.
Yeah.
And just even just sitting in that room with fellow marketeers, because it was in Derby as well. I mean, I was with people from Rolls Royce and people from Thornton's Chocolates, because that's based up.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting next to a guy who was a marketeer for an aggregates company, so concrete.
Okay.
You were doing boilers. And I remember sitting there thinking, and I was talking about all the stuff I was doing. I was doing live music events and I was doing DJs and I was doing nights with champagne and bottles of vodka and stuff like that. Yeah. These guys are like, oh, we market boilers and we market concrete. And thinking, hospitality has to be probably the most fun and easiest thing to market.
Yeah.
When it comes to a desirability perspective. And everyone was just so jealous of me in that room when I was doing the degree of the stuff I was putting in my case studies, and I was doing live examples of doing it in the venues I was working on at the time.
Yeah.
But like I said, it was completely by accident, but at the same time, looking back, I tend to think it was quite constructed from the guys that were mentoring me at the time.
Yeah.
The guys like Mary and Nicola, who are now at Brennan and Price, and Claire, who's now at Marsden's, the only time I feel like they were molding me into it because they saw something in me that I didn't know was there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the way it should be, you know, and I think, you know, as I'm getting older and the grey hairs coming in and stuff like that, you know, that's what you want to spend your time doing. You know, you want to help sort of, I don't mean bring up or patronise me, but you want to help develop the next gens that are coming through, because like you, I mean, I did a marketing degree, but, you know, it wasn't like from a great business school or anything like that. And I was learning on the job. I didn't know what the lingo meant. And, you know, I luckily thought fast in a few meetings that I was in about, you know, I remember one at lastminute.com, we're talking about 6 sheets and 48 sheets and what I think we should do on the back of the metro and all these things. And I had nothing prepared, you know, but I sort of managed to work out what they were talking about. But then as soon as I got back to my desk, I phoned our media agency and said, look, do you mind giving me a 101 in this stuff, you know. So I think if you're kind of agile and, you know, quite sort of, I guess, under your own initiative, you just go, I don't know that, I'm hungry to learn, so I'll find out. Then, you know, that's the way that it goes. And then I guess, you know, another great brand you're involved with was Pop World as well. So, yeah, I mean, you really saw that from its inception to be in 40 cities, which is unbelievable.
Yeah, it was a great brand. I mean, again, that came about with, I did my time at Slug and Lettuce, and then the ops director at the time spotted, and the marketing director, Richard Bruce, who'd come in from, I think he's coming from Argos.
Mm-hmm.
But he came in and they'd bought Emmett Mitchell and Butler at Stonegate, and they bought all these late night venues, and then almost didn't realize what they were going to do with them all. It's just a hybrid mix of different brands and portfolios and everything. And then somebody spotted that I had late night on my CV. Conversations developed from there as they are. So that was my first marketing manager job. And Pop World was an easy brand to manage, partly because I see it a lot, and you probably see it as well. I see so many marketeers that go into brands and think, I'm going to leave a legacy on this brand. I'm going to leave my stamp on it. Yeah. I'm going to change the logo from this. I'm going to change the colors, or I'm going to reposition it from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
And Pop World, I didn't have to do that. All I had to do was be the brand protector.
Yeah.
To get down to its values, which was, it was fun, it was safe, it was consistent. That was it. It was nice and simple. And then all of a sudden, it just organically grew. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember big 13 sites, and our awareness scores were higher than like 80 Slug and Lettuce's.
Was there a licensing link with the magazine Pop World, or it was not completely devoid?
And people always were thinking, it wasn't even a Stonegate brand. It was a Mitchell and Butler brand. Mitchell and Butler done really well for years. They always had this pipeline of party bars. So they did Flares, ran its course, and then they did an NPD site for Reflex, and then rolled the Reflex out.
Yeah.
Pop World was the next one. So they'd done Pop World Liverpool as their first version, and then Stonegate bought them out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an inherited brand that's said sat in the 90s era, cheesy party music. But at the same time, everyone who visited, and I've been there several times on, because I'm a massive Liverpool fan, so I'm up there quite frequently visiting the match and the bars and follow the crowd, and before you know it, you're dancing in the street, and it was Pop World that was in the whole time.
Yeah.
And then it was an incredible brand, because like I said, we just had to protect it. We just had to protect it. We just had to keep it memorable. We just had to stick to the DNA. We didn't have to change it too much.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to the point in the end where we had customers almost emailing us on a daily basis saying, please bring one to my city. Please bring
one.
And so
there was one in Brighton, right? Or is one?
Still there.
Yeah. And they're still trading? They've still got 40 cities? How many cities have it got now?
Yeah, about 42, I think, 45.
What?
And then last year alone, they took over the M&S Arena Liverpool and did a 10,000 capacity sellout festival.
Oh, great.
And they do festivals in Leeds City Centre every summer as well now for 15,000 or whatever it is. So the brand has continued to grow, partly because it's exactly the same brand as it was when I was on it all them years ago. It's not really changed. We've got some great stories of just the loyalty and the love that we embedded in people. We've got customers who've got Pop World tattoos. Not endorsed by us, but they've got the Pop World logo tattooed in their arm, and they now get free entry for life for doing it. We used to do Pop World in their living room, where we'd take a Pop World DJ, the venue, dyad, flashy dance floor, and do it in people's a surprise and delight in people's living rooms when they came home from university.
Amazing.
Get home to be a party there.
Yeah.
I think there's one guy who's been to every single Pop World in the country.
Yeah.
Whenever there's a new one, he's there front of the queue, but he follows them around the country, and he's been to every single one. He doesn't get paid by us in any way or shape or form.
Yeah.
An avid fan.
Loves it. That's brilliant. No, I mean, you can't buy that. I mean, especially the tattoos and all that. You can't really buy that kind of attraction. And then, you know, I was just thinking about launching these sites then. You know, was there a sort of launch pack, sort of secret approach or secret weapons when you were opening one of these? Like, how did you bring the noise to like get people aware that it was happening?
Yeah, he said that a lot of the hard work was done for us because his awareness scores were so high.
Mm-hmm.
You'd speak to anyone, and people had always been to a Pop World in another city, whether it was Birmingham or or Liverpool or Manchester. They'd all been to one and experienced one. It was just a matter of time before we took it to their town or city. And because of the Stonegate portfolio, we always had that access to a massive pipeline of sites.
Mm-hmm.
We almost just had to pick the right venue at the right time and change it into a pop world. But yeah, we always tried to launch the huge bang, as you'd expect, massive social media coverage. And then the signature piece for us was always bringing a pop star to that pop world for that night.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had nights out with the guys from Five and Atomic Kitten and Bewitched and Steps and S Club 7 and all of them, because we used to constantly just get them all booked for live tours just to get them in for the launch. A massive queue of people down the street wanting to be in. So that was a big thing as well, was causing that hype. Something I learned from a speech that sticks in my mind from Bob Senior back in old Malaysia was, his brief was, I always want a queue so big that if you look down from the moon, it looks like the Earth's got a scarf.
Oof.
That was his brief on a launch night. And so you had to purposely try and build a big queue outside your venue to know you've built that hype.
That's crazy.
And then it was just your like I said, fun, safe, and consistent, keeping your music on point. So we had a DJ sat on my team, and his job was to go around and do music audits.
Mm-hmm.
Every Friday, Saturday, he'd travel the country and just visit venues and check the DJ was on point and he was playing the right songs and he was doing it, because we had to keep it so tight on brand.
Mm-hmm.
No matter which pop world you went to, you were getting the same music. We couldn't afford anyone to go off pitch and start playing different types of music.
Yeah.
90s cheesy pop. It was very distinct about what was in. We were very distinct around creating peak moments of the atmosphere. So you'd have that, I used to always describe it as a head in the back of your neck moment.
Yeah.
Where if you can drop the volume of a big song at a big time and everyone in the crowd sings along.
We'll jump in.
Yeah, and we'll jump in and you have that head in the back of your neck moment as a customer where you go, I'm part of something special.
Yeah.
You go away with all their memories. So we'd have that. We'd have USPs around drinks. We'd have a massive Partini vessel, which was a huge martini glass, which was designed to share, but a lot of people just bought them individually.
Mm-hmm.
We were really just generous as well in our launch to come to giveaways, Pop World Tarts. Everyone loved the glasses and the Hawaiian Lays and everything we did. It was at one point we were constantly opening probably about one or two a month. It was just a constant conveyor belt of different Pop Worlds around the country as we were debadging other venues and putting Pop Worlds in.
And what was their capacity, Willie?
They're all very small. The secret formula we found for Pop World was 300 capacity. They could trade 3 nights a week and trade till 3 a.m. Mm. That was the three things we looked for when we were doing our site analysis. Was if you can get 300 capacity and get a good 200 people in there on a 3 nights a week, whether it's a student night plus your 2 weekends, and then trade it till 3 a.m. in the morning, that was enough for a successful pop world. You can see you got big ones. I think the Birmingham one's the old Ministry of Sound building, like three floors.
Mm-hmm.
But and we've even got them on the Tattershall Castle, which is a pub boat on the.
They
have a pop world.
A few good nights on there, down in the Thames, the embankment.
Yeah. They're everywhere now. So like you said, the brands has gone from strength to strength, and it's credit to all those that were involved in it in the early days, and then those who've protected it ever since.
Yeah, nice. And then what about obviously multi award winning? So congratulations. So winning back to back publishing awards and marketer of the year at UKH for the Dust Till Dawn stuff is phenomenal. So. What's been the sort of proudest campaigns, and can you talk about the campaigns that won you those? I mean, that's cracking news.
Yeah, we went through a good period of it, honestly. The public awards, as you know, it's such a robust process.
Yeah.
It's the award to win because of how meticulous it is from and all the different assets of things. So winning that back to back, I mean, we were against the likes of proper late night operas like Recom, who were Luminar at the time, and.
Yeah.
Revolution Bars were in their prime, and we were punching above our weight. We were a collection of 84 almost toys that just weren't wanted.
Mm-hmm.
We were describing it as in Stone, you had its core brands. You had your looking at it, says, I don't really quite be at one at the time. There was all the core brands going on, and then you had all these misfits of other stuff from acquisitions that were just bundled together because they were opened late.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we went about as a team was just we distinctly plugged them to different brands. We had our iconic nightclubs that were our big venues with, you know, what you'd expect, disco lights, house music, that sort of thing. There's loads of unbranded ones around the country. We had our Pop Worlds in one, or Music Bars, which are Reflex and Flares. And I think the way we won it for them many years when it comes to Publicans and the UKH Dusk Till Dawn Award was because we were so multifaceted in our approach. We had the LGBT venues. We Stonegate owns most of Soho, which not many people realise, but they own most of the big venues. They own the Two Brewers in Clapham, which is just iconic.
Yep.
You know, phenomenal late night venues in that space. And we just embraced them all together and learned from it. So we took drag queens out of the LGBT space and put them into like so Pop World and other venues.
Mm-hmm.
We linked them together through campaigns that we did. And I remember one year we did a pride map that people have for pride to navigate them around all the different venues that Stonegate had around Leicester Square, Charing Cross area.
Mm-hmm.
We did, you know, lip sync and dance competitions, which all 84 venues do heats. And then it builds up to a crescendo of a national final and a big check on stage and all that type of thing. So link them all together. We had a less is more approach when it came to the amount of campaigns we did. We focused on the big monthly pay weekenders because that was our bread and butter. But then we'd also chuck in some big national campaigns along, like I said, national competitions and signature dates like Pride and Christmas and Halloween. And it just worked really well for us because we were a small team, but we delivered a lot. I mean, the guys on my team now, you could see how successful we're now because of what they've gone on to do. I mean, Tom Patrick, now marketing director for Banana Tree.
Yeah,
and wow. He was in my team there as a young exec marketing manager learning his trade. And because we did so much quantity and quality campaigns, whether it was focusing on Stag and Hens or bottle to table packages, because we were at the front end of that, of delivering bottles of vodka with sparklers and all that type of thing, we just tried to really just to do as much as possible and used all our different brands to put the detail into it. But yeah, it was a great time to be part of it. And I think Stonegate was the best performing division. And the venues was the best performing division in Stonegate for a long time because of all the success we were having at that key time.
Mm. And then thinking about sort of now and how it is trading out there, you know, it's really tough for most people. There's various stats out there about market shrinking or flat or whatever. But, you know, I've got a few clients that, distinct to their particular area, it feels like there are fewer people going out, spending less, going out fewer times. So in terms of that, you know, have you got any sort of tips of advice for marketing, any marketing teams listening, when it comes to acquisition or retention, that, you know, you would be advising right now? You know, how can you drive sales? Because the most common brief that I usually get is, you know, can you help me raise my sales by, pick a number, you know, $5,000 a week, $2,000 a week, $10,000 a week, whatever it is. But also I don't want to spend too much and I don't have the team to execute. Da, da, da. So yeah, what would be the sort of advice there for you?
Yeah, the way I always go about this with my clients right now is do a review of your reasons to visit.
Mm.
Reasons to visit, having that strong lineup of 7 days a week, things happening in your venue, your pub, your bar, your restaurant, whether you go down a discounted route or you go down the value add route, there is too many people I see with empty chalkboards out there with not much going on. They've almost got to the stage where they've retracted so much, they're just opening the door and hoping people come in. And I always say, go down the reasons to visit route. I mean, and I know it's probably a shameless plug for my pub quiz client, but the data we get from our app shows that we're driving an average of 7 quiz teams in every quiz we're in every pub we're in. 7 quiz teams. And then you got times that by 4 people per quiz team and £10 a head spend as you would these days. It adds up to a bit. So review your rhythms a week. Make sure you've got a different range of activity in, whether it's a pub quiz or a karaoke or a Domino's night or a local community night or something. Everywhere I say that's winning have got their rhythm of the week in place.
Yeah.
Like I said, it doesn't have to be experiential. It can be value-led, but having that mixture where you know 7 days a week if you've got stuff happening, because people are experience seekers these days. And whether it's a Tuesday night or a Saturday night, they're still choosing their experiences wisely because nobody wants a crap night out.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I always say to people is just make sure that you're reviewing that. And then also, I just think it's about you just knowing where you're going to acquire your customers from and how you're going to acquire them. And that's where my marketing order helps a lot. It's about reviewing all the different channels of, is your social media getting in? So you had Jack on a few weeks back talking about that, and it's completely right what he says. It's all about making sure that you've got that you're all your channels are doing the work for you.
Yeah.
And I actually think as well there's a big move as well towards localization of marketing, as in not just during the week, but then how you network, how you then are bringing back customers through the experience you're delivering. Yeah. I always look at customer feedback. It's something I always learned off. I can't remember. Might have been one of your podcasts. Emma, who was at Wagamama's.
Mm-hmm.
Read every bit of customer feedback every morning. Yeah. Morning. Every single bit. Good, bad, or ugly. Write every single bit before she started a day. And I was the same when I was in marketing as well. But it was Nightcap of Stonegate. I did exactly the same because you get the gems off that data. You get the gems off your burger's not as good as a burger next door, or your service is a bit slow, or your pints are a bit too expensive. You start to realize why you're losing customers, and it's fixable. It's completely fixable from then. So I would say get into your customer feedback data, review you within the week, and then just review your acquisition, which sounds like a fancy marketing, but just review where your customers are coming from, where they come to. Is it website? Is it social media? Is it bookings? And just make sure it's as seamless experience as you can.
Yeah.
But I do actually think, I know you said people are struggling right now, but I do think there is still customers out there.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
There's definitely customers online looking for stuff. There's definitely people booking. I just think you've got to do more to earn that booking. You've got to do more work to get there. And then you've got to deliver a faultless experience when they do come to you.
Yeah. No, 100%. I think, you know, one of the things about the customer feedback, you know, I think that there's a arrogance almost amongst marketers that's, well, I know what's best, or you know. And I think from that point of view, it's all sitting there for you, you know. And I think in terms of the, you know, the experience itself and all the rest of it, there's no way that you could possibly be in 7 days a week having a neutral experience, because they know who you are and all that. So yeah, I think there's just so many people that just don't pay enough attention or respect to their customer feedback, or, well, maybe that's untrue. Maybe I think it's act upon it, you know, actually do something about it, because all the themes will be there. So I think it's a great source. And I think when I worked at Yo Sushi, it was the first thing we looked at in the board meeting. We never looked at figures. I mean, we sort of knew roughly what was going on, but we did look at them later in the meeting. But, you know, going into it, that was the first thing we would see. And then, funnily enough, the places with less good reviews on the traffic light system, there was a big straight line to how they were performing. So,
well, it always links up, Mark. The sales and customer feedback always marry up when you look at it. It always does. And, yeah, you're right. And I think another way around it from what you just said there is, I think that marketers need to take control of customer experience, because it always falls down a gap.
Yeah.
Operators are almost half involved. You've got marketers half involved. And I think whenever I went to a new job, I always said, give me it. I don't know where customer experience sits. Oh, it sits in operations. No, it now sits in marketing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to analyze it on a weekly basis. I want to track, create an action list and speak to the operators about what they're doing around these common trends. If the common trends are around waiting times, or the common trend is around food quality, I want to be able to speak to them direct. And that's how I always approached it. And I think, yeah, marketers should take control of customer experience, because it's an acquisition and retention tool at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And it's always a bit of a battle. Who does it sit with? But I think if you've got that mutual respect between operations and marketing, then, you know, it makes things a lot easier from that perspective. But, you know, I've seen it go other ways where, you know, if I had went into the ops team and said, oh, that sits with me in Yo Sushi, they'd have told me to beetle off, and there was about 10 of them and one of me. So yeah, it was probably not going to happen. But, you know, as long as you can have some kind of constructive input and all look at it together to solve any problems that there are, it's definitely the right thing. So just kind of looking at time, so there's a couple of things I was just going to ask you about, was future plans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's happening with you next? And also be interesting to just think about, you know, what do you think this year in hospitality and hospitality marketing is going to look like as well?
Yeah. I mean, future plans for Spaceman is, like I said, business is really good at the minute. got 5 days a week of clients, got exciting pipeline projects in with some spirit brands and people like After the Future, helping them with some launch in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also just about to start some work with Karen at Purple Story on a marketing module. I think there's a massive gap for a localization marketing module. And that's one thing I miss about the corporate world was training. I used to love doing my training sessions with people around, helping them identify their competitors or help them with their customer experience service cycle or how to deliver the perfect atmosphere. I used to do them sessions all the time, and it's one part I miss. So yeah, I reached out to Karen and said, look, I've got this idea around a marketing module. Purple Story, want to collab together? And she said, yeah, send it across. So yeah, we're just kicking that off right now. So that would be an exciting next step for me. And yeah, just build my team. I'm on the cusp of hopefully finding an office now. Just for a couple of days a week, partly because I'm trying to, I'm looking to take on someone to help me with all the technical side of what I do, the Google side and all of that. And I could have brought in another freelancer, but I've decided I'm going to bring in, take like a T-level apprentice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
From a local college, from Derby College. There's loads of kids in there who are doing these T-levels, as they're now called, not A-levels.
Yeah.
And they're looking for placement. And as you know, they're just more savvy in digital and tech than anyone. And I just thought, I can give someone a placement that can help me with all my digital audits of doing the Google and the analytics. And a part of that is I've got to find an office to be able to accommodate someone. So that's my next step, is get an office, get an apprentice in to help me with some stuff. And then, hopefully just keep growing it bit by bit. And like I said earlier, survive month by month. That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah, off hand to mouth always. And then, marketing and hospitality. What do you think the next year's going to look like?
Yeah, I mean, the two biggest buzzwords right now, and it's what I always speak to, and I've mentioned it many times a day, is acquisition and retention. Every time I speak to anyone, I think anyone worth their salt right now, any pub group, bar group, restaurant group, nightclubs, whatever, you need to be looking at your acquisition and retention strategy of how are you getting customers and how are you keeping them? Because the data's there. I work with people with huge databases that are just sat there and they haven't got engagement journeys set up. They haven't got birthday messages going out. They haven't got lapsed user journeys going out. They haven't got any of it.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because you almost don't need to go out and fight on the street for new customers or put expensive paid social campaigns together because you've got a database of people who've visited you and the last few years, and you've just got to speak to them right and try and convert them across. So I think that's where hospitality is going for me, is more how do they focus more on speaking to their customers better and driving them to the event, the visit back into venue. I also think there'll be a boom of loyalty schemes. It's an interesting space. I'd love to get your opinions on it, but it's an interesting space when it comes to hospitality loyalty, because I don't think anyone's quite cracked it. Do you know what I mean? When it comes to the Tesco club card or the Pret subscription, you look at all these great things out and then you look at the pubs and bars and you still get people with cardboard stamps, collect 9, get your 10th pint free, and you still get people who are going down the route of apps. I'm like, please don't get an app. You don't need an app. You need an Apple Wallet sort of QR point. Like the Box Park one. I think the Box Park's probably the best one out there. I think loyalty obviously complements your CRM. So I think right now when I'm speaking to people, it's how are you acquiring customers? What's your marketing funnel look like? And then what you've got in their loyalty scheme, CRM, to talk to them better and keep them coming back.
Yeah, I mean, loyalty is a hard one, I suppose, in that the ones that we know are the best are usually quite punchy as well. But then I think about ones like, I think Gales is a really good one. And also it depends how much brand love and brand loyalty there is. If it's just for your local pub, they're not going to have usually the expertise or the whatever to do it. If it's then part of a big group, it kind of turns some people off because that feels like their pub and they didn't know it was part of this big mothership thing. And there's a lot of complexity. I think that it really is just about doing your homework and saying, well, what is it that you want to happen by having this loyalty scheme? But I don't think there's enough two-way loyalty schemes. I don't think the subscription thing is came in enough, and I think I'd be really interested to see people do that, because, you know, I think for certain places I absolutely would. And I think we're, you know, we can be quite behind the curve, you know, when it comes to marketing and hospitality, and, you know, we're behind America a lot of the time, and we're definitely behind other industries. I mean, if you look at loyalty and retail, it's off the charts. But, you know, I guess I would consider Pret as hospitality. But, you know, in the pubs and bars arena, I haven't seen loads of great ones. And I just think it is, when you've got a half a person, one person, two person marketing team, they probably don't have the expertise. And then so many loyalty providers, for example, they work with the big FMCG, and they say, there's no way. I mean, obviously, you know, there are people like Vita Mojo out there, and, you know, there are other, you know, providers of, you know, the sort of loyalty side of things. But it'd be worth just having loads of chats. But I think people need to start at, why do they want a loyalty scheme? What do they want to do? What behaviour do they want to change? And then I think what can happen is people go, oh, great, we'll have a loyalty scheme and we'll just switch that on when we want, and then we'll make money. And it's like, well, it needs to be much more of a two-way thing. And there's big risks as well. You know, if you've got points out there, how long do they last for? You know, and after COVID, if you look at some of the best loyalty schemes out there, there's no end date. So how do you reconcile that with your P&L, and that'll scare the life out of people if everyone wants to cash it in straight away? And then all of a sudden, what, are you going to do it on a Monday and a Tuesday night because that suits you? And, you know, there's all these things to sort of look at. You know, what age are your customers and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, but I think a good afternoon on ChatGPT quizzing it always helps. And then, you know, just watching as many YouTube videos and looking at case studies and talk to people. You know, if you see that you like Emirates or Hilton Honors or whatever, pick up the phone and just say, look, we're thinking of doing this. Would you have 10 minutes to just tell me about it, you know, and what your experience is? But one of the big things I learned lately was points seems to be the way to go, not pounds.
Right.
Definitely seem to be one of the ways to go. And then there's other ways to thank people as well, you know, whether it is this is on the house or, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, obviously data's great for us marketers, but it doesn't always need to be, you know, automated in data within an inch of its life. You know, I think you could maybe have a two, like Gales do that. So they've got the Vita Mojo, you know, powered loyalty scheme. But I was in the other week there, the one in Brighton, and they still gave me a free loaf and a bunch of cakes because it was the end of the day and they were going to go to waste anyway. So, I mean, that's an even better scenario where you've got the points that you sort of expected, but then you got this unexpected bit on top. So there was that kind of tech and human working beautifully in harmony, you know? So yeah, it's a tough one, but yeah, we're always that wee bit behind, and I don't think it's for the want of ideas or talent or anything like that. I think a lot of time it's budget, time, resource, you know, and also people don't want to risk building something huge and it doesn't work. So yeah, it'll be interesting to look at. So there's a couple of wee things then just before we go. So just a fun part of the podcast where we talk about the market out of 10 questions. It's not market out of 10 really, but just your favourite things. So favourite city to eat in?
Oh, I've got to say San Francisco.
Nice.
Yeah, I remember getting there after a late night plane from Las Vegas after a energetic few days there and having a lobster roll on San Francisco Bay. It was the best lobster roll I've ever had in my life.
Nice.
And there's also a pizza restaurant there called Tony's that's like 11-year world pizza champion or something. They cook on coal, they cook on wood, they cook on gas. They do everything there, so. And obviously the clam chowder in San Fran is just renowned as well. So yeah, recommend if you have a few days, just go to a few, escape Vegas, go to San Fran, now a flight, and then you've just got a good few places around there to try.
And what about your favourite hotel?
Oh, do you know what it is? I'm a big fan, probably remarked and had on here, it's just Malmaison.
Yeah.
I just love their tone of voice. I absolutely adore it. I adore everything about it. It's customer journey. It's you always get a good night's sleep there. And as you know, in hospitality, you spend many nights away, don't you? And but yeah, my go-to. I actually think they're actually quite good value as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to say Malmaison.
Nice. No, great choice. What a brand as well. Phenomenal. And it's still kept its cool, I think. You know, it's still, we've got one in Brighton down here, and yeah, definitely still kept its cool and its intrigue. Favourite coffee shop? And what would you be having?
Oh, I'm not sure if you've heard of them, but there's a chain starting up around the Midlands right now called Bear.
I have. I've seen it online, actually. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Every time I have an admin day, I will go. There's several around me. I like, I'm partial to an oat milk, flat white, and then they do the best cinnamon bun, which complements it, especially when I've had a long run in the morning, just to put them calories back on with a cinnamon bun. It's just... Yeah. And yeah, I think the service is great. And they have one of these unique things. It's a Wi-Fi system where you don't have to log on, and it takes you a million questions. You literally press a button and you're live online without any secret word or asking someone. Do you know what I mean? Little things like that make a big difference, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, that's huge. That's huge. I guess the trade-off is, I wonder how much data they're getting, but you never know. You never know. Favourite bar, and what would you be drinking?
Oh, it depends on the occasion. But like I said earlier, if I'm watching Sport the Box, I love the Box, everything they do. I love Albert Schloss as well. There's no brands. Everyone's had their best nights out in there. But I also think, again, with my nightcap hat on, everyone's had an amazing night at London Cocktail Club.
100%.
The vibe that JJ Goodman drives, and then venues and the energy. And you've had nights where you go in at 10 p.m. and the next minute it's 4 a.m. and you've been pouring tequila down your neck.
Yeah.
And drink of choice, espresso martini every time.
We had one round the corner from my old agency. We are spectacular in Marketplace, and I had a couple of great nights in there. And I think one of the nights I went in, and it was playing almost kind of like 90s emo sort of stuff, and it was all like My Chemical Romance and all that kind of punk pop sort of stuff. And I was just unexpected. I think I went in and just didn't really know what to expect, and I was like, I just walked away going, that was one of the best nights I've had, you know, swinging the lights and everybody up on the bar and all that. It was great. And then the last one is a favourite restaurant, and what would you be having there?
Oh, my favourite restaurant, and this stems back to the project I was doing on Stonegate when we were rolling out the premium chapter collection food concepts, was I spent a lot of time in the Wigmore, Astor Langham, and I think they do one of the best burgers out there, but they do the best cheese toastie.
Yeah.
They do the metal on top of it, and it comes to your table. And if you, their Scotch eggs, I still can't work out how they make their Scotch eggs. It's way down the Google, I've looked at them, but they're like little strands of like nests. But honestly, for value for money, and you don't have to book, and it's a great experience, and they've got a great selection of beers on tap, it has to be the Wigmore. And even if I go back now on my odd day week, I'm in London, I'll try and swing by just to have the cheese toastie and a cheeky pint.
Sounds good. Any others?
If I'm out of the family, I love Wagamama's.
Oh yeah.
I just don't think you can knock that guest journey of even just getting your food at different times. It works. It works, and it's hot and it's fresh and it feels healthy. My kids love it. So it's something for everyone there. And yeah, it's our treat occasion every month when all the invoices have been paid, is that we all go to Wagamama's and order too much food for the table. And again, you walk away feeling I've had a healthy meal and feeling quite wholesome. It's quite weird, but I've not found a bad one yet, from its customer service to the way you hosted it. I think it's an amazing brand.
Yeah, it's really special. I don't know what they've done on Deliveroo, but they've done, I don't know if this is changing the restaurant, but you can't get the chili chicken ramen has changed. And I don't know why. And it's just not the same at all. And yeah, the ingredients have just all changed. The taste of it's changed. In fact, I don't even know if you can get it. They might have done it so you only get chili chicken ramen if you go in.
Right.
But yeah, it's so weird. So it's kind of put me off. I've stopped ordering it. I'm going to go other places now. So yeah, I probably should go back in and have a wee nosy. But you can get a normal one, but then you've got to add some chili sambok or something to it. But it's doesn't really taste the same. So yeah, odd one. But anyway, that's my issue rather than yours. So that's great. Well, listen, it's been so great to chat with you, and you know, after all this time chatting online, and great to hear about all your experiences and your advice for everyone as well. And yeah, we could have talked for another half an hour actually, looking at the questions that were still left there. But yeah, maybe get another part two at some point and just check in on your journey and see how you're going.
Good. Sounds good. Thanks, Mark. As I said, massive fan, so keep up the good work, mate.
Thanks so much. All right, take care, bud. Cheers.
Cheers, cheers. Bye.
So there we go. A fantastic look into the world of spaceman marketing with Alan Armstrong. Thanks to Alan for putting his hand up and saying he fancied coming on the show. Actually, it felt remiss of me because we've chatted so many times and I've always meant to chat to him about coming on and seeing his point of view, especially it's a very unique one, being so grounded in operations and having worked for some of the best brands across hospitality's experience really is vital. And it's great to chat to people like that because they've always got so many great tips that are just so practical for you in your marketing department with you and your teams to drive those sales, whether it's acquisition or retention. So I wish Alan all the best, and it was nice to take a little trip to the Midlands and up north with his accent, and hopefully he's going to do extremely well. And if you need any help on your marketing at all for your business, then drop a line to Alan at Spaceman Marketing.
This podcast is sponsored by Vita Mojo, the all-in-one restaurant management platform helping operators grow ATV, reduce tech complexity, and serve guests better. Just visit vitamojo.com/supersonic and get in touch with the team right away. That's vitamojo.com/supersonic. So this is me, Mark McSee, signing off for another podcast, and I'm really looking forward to the next time we're together. Next time, we'll hear from many, many more interesting people with top tips, tricks, and tales that will make your brand boom.